Today is Friday, May 6th, 2011. This is Susan Resnick. I'm in the Department of Special Collections and University Archives at San Diego State University, where I'll be recording the oral history of Stephen L. Weber, President of San Diego State University. This interview is part of the Oral History Project, funded by a John and Jane Addams mini-grant. President Weber is the seventh president of San Diego State University. He assumed the presidency in 1996 and is now stepping down. He is a graduate of Bowling Green University with a BA in philosophy. He received his PhD in philosophy from Notre Dame in 1969. He is the author of numerous articles on philosophy and on higher education. He is a dynamic and beloved leader who involves students, faculty, staff, alumni, and the community in shaping shared vision, a roadmap for the university's future. He has received numerous honors, awards, and fellowships. Among them are Distinguished Alumnus of the Year, Bowling Green State University in 2004, Peacemaker Award, San Diego Mediation Center, 1997, Honorary Degree, Beijing Capital Normal University, Beijing, China, 1994, Outstanding Humanities Teacher at the University of Maine, 1975. As a public servant, he has served on the board of the San Diego Foundation. He has also served as the past chair of the American Association of State College and University Board of Directors. He co-chairs Partners for K-12 Scholarships, the board of directors of the San Diego Regional Economic Development Corporation. I am delighted and honored to have the opportunity to collaborate with President Weber today to create his oral history. Good morning, President Weber.
Good morning, Susan.
Let's begin at the beginning. Tell me about where and when you were born.
I was born on March 17, 1942, St. Patrick's Day. It's always been a pleasure to have a birthday on St. Patrick's Day, particularly when I was at Notre Dame. I was born in Boston, Massachusetts.
And tell me about your family.
Well, let's go back. My grandfather, Weber, was an executive with United Shoe Machinery Corporation and did a good deal of work abroad. He was in Germany during World War I and was kept there by the German government, imprisoned there. His family was allowed to go home. The malnutrition that he suffered during World War I caused an early death for him. My grandmother was a very strong woman who I knew. I didn't know my grandfather Weber because he had died long before I was born, but my grandmother Weber I knew, a very strong-willed woman who had raised the family often on her own while her husband was in Europe. Very international couple. My grandfather Warnes, my mother's name was Catherine Warnes. My grandfather Warnes, John, was a farmer, but that doesn't really capture it. He was an entrepreneur. He and my grandmother had five children, one of whom died at the age of 20, had been blind. I'm not sure the nature of his illness, but he died at around the age of 20. Mm-hmm. Three sons, all of whom were farmers in the vicinity of Toledo, Ohio, and my mother, and my grandfather Warnes bought each of his children a farm, including his daughter, which was unusual at the time. As I said, he was very much of an entrepreneur. So he was one of the founders of the grain co-op in Stony Ridge, Ohio. You cannot imagine how rural Stony Ridge, Ohio was and still is. And he also founded the bank there, Farmer Savings Bank, it was called. And my grandmother was a traditional farm wife, at least it seemed that way to me, raised her own family, made spectacular pumpernickel bread, just spectacular pumpernickel bread. But as you can gather from those names of Weber and Warren's, our heritage is German, mm-hmm. and hence the pumpernickel bread. My grandfather and I used to enjoy her pumpernickel bread. Was so dense that we used to have contests as to who could slice it the thinnest. And you could slice it extraordinarily thin, and it was still very, very rich. He was, as I said, a farmer, just an inventive man. He had a wonderful workshop that I remember being in as a kid with his own forge. You know, farmers have to make things.
Yeah.
He designed in the barn. He designed a chute for loading sheep or pigs or cattle onto trucks, and it was wonderfully designed so that it it folded into the wall, and the door would open outward, and then the chute would fall forward out towards the truck, and then there'd be a gate that popped up on the other side, and we had a natural path to lead the livestock up to the truck. And he did lots of things of that sort. So I remember his old forge had, as those hand-fired forges do, had a crank on the side of it. And as a kid, I got to crank the forge. Uh-huh. My father was born in Frankfurt, Germany. As I said, they were spending a lot of time in Germany. My grandmother Weber had the notion, she was concerned about his citizenship since he was being born in Germany. So, and of course he was born at home. So there was literally an American flag over the bed, because that was her sense of being born under the American flag. It's a very literal sense of that.
That's great.
It is. My mother was the only daughter in the family, as I said earlier, and she lived a very, very interesting life. She was on the women's basketball team that won the championship in the state of Ohio. She went off to become a nurse, the only one to have any formal higher education in the family,
yeah.
And graduated the top of her class, and there's a certification exam at that time in the state of Ohio, and she had the best grades in the state on that exam. But then she married a high school coach, and he died almost immediately, I think within a year or two, of an infection that would have been trivial to us now, but without sulfur drugs and everything, it killed him. She went off then to be an airline stewardess, one of the very first airline stewardesses for United Airlines, because you then had to be a nurse or maybe a college graduate. I'm not, but one of the ways you could be a stewardess was to be a nurse. She was very, very attractive, and then for a while went to New York and was a Powers model in New York. But didn't like that, returned to the airlines. She met my dad in Nashville, Tennessee, when she was flying in and out of Nashville, Tennessee. He at that time was now working for United Shoe Machinery Corporation, as his father had. And since that was a kind of New England industry, we ended up, as I said, I was born in Boston, and they lived with me in Belmont when I was really small, then Worcester, Massachusetts, until, I'm going to guess, I was 6 or 7 years old. Then we moved to Marblehead, Massachusetts, which is on the North Shore above Boston. My father became the general manager for United Shoe Machinery Corporation's plant in Lynn, Massachusetts. And he then also had a very early death. He died when I was nine of a heart attack. But an interesting thing leapt ahead. He and the family were living in Larchmont, outside of New York City, for quite a while. And there's a branch of the family that is sort of Philadelphia-based and in that part of the world. And then the family, his mother and father moved out to San Francisco. And when he was high school age, or maybe young college age, and high school age, and he was, I gather, a handful as a kid. And so, strangely enough, he was sent to San Diego and enrolled in the Army Navy Academy, which was then in downtown San Diego, over by Garnet Avenue, I think. And we've still got the yearbooks. This would have been 1930-31 kind of period. Interesting enough, the yearbooks show he was a very good athlete, and they show pictures of him playing tennis and playing golf and playing basketball. There's no picture of him ever in the library, and I think there's a reason for that. But in any event, he then went on to, I think it was Santa Monica Junior College, but I'm not sure of that. And he never pursued his education beyond that.
Did you have any siblings?
I do have two siblings, John and Roger. John is 3 years younger than I am. He now lives in Wauseon, which is a suburb of Toledo, sort of west of Toledo. And Roger, who lives in Michigan, forgotten the address right now, but just west of Detroit. John was a businessman. He went to Berea College in Ohio. Served in I don't know whether it was the Army National Guard or the Air Force National Guard. Served in the National Guard, and ultimately became part of the extended auto industry in that part of the country. And he retired early in his mid 50s, and he was then also the, I'm not sure of the title, but I think he was the general manager of a company near Toledo that makes gaskets and things like that to supply the auto industry. He and his wife Sharon are still very, very much happy and healthy and enjoying their lives. My youngest brother Roger was 9 years younger than I am, and remember I said that my father died when I was nine.
Yes.
The interesting thing is that Roger was 2 weeks old. So my mother was left with three sons to raise, and did a spectacular job of it. But I've always suspected, since Roger was born so much later, that he was a surprise. But if so, it turned out to be a really great surprise, because as I left the house to go to school, and eventually John did, Roger was still there and became a real companion for my mother. And my mother was a very good public speaker and always interested in things of that sort. And Roger became a broadcaster. He went to Bowling Green State University, as I did, majored in communications and journalism, even as a student was doing student news broadcasts, which my mother could pick up from where she lived. We commuted to Bowling Green State. And so But then he became a reporter in the Toledo area and eventually in Detroit. So he works now for NBC in Detroit and has worked there for at least 25 years, which is a really long time, obviously, in the in that business.
Yeah.
And he has two children, and John has one.
Well, as you described the beginnings of your childhood with the pumpernickel bread, I'm salivating. But tell me also about family holidays, what your early memories, school.
Well, let me start by saying when my father died, my mother, who was, as I said, the only daughter and a nurse, went back to Ohio in part to care for her aging parents and also to raise her three sons under the influences of her brothers, farmers over there. And there was no particular reason to stay in Marblehead, Massachusetts, even though it offered a much better life for her. It wasn't as good a place to raise us.
Yeah.
So we grew up with our cousins, and particularly an Uncle Bob was a real influence on me, but I think it's true for John as well. And then Uncle Ernie and Uncle Herm, I mean, these were hard-working farmers and great work ethic, really good at what they did, but worked very hard to be good at what they did.
Yeah.
So a lot of holidays meant large celebrations with cousins, and as it happened, there were about a dozen cousins there, and there was a cluster that were the oldest ones, as I was, and they were all about the same age. So we kind of hung out together, and then there was another group more or less John's age and another group more or less Roger's age. So the cousins would break up. But when my grandparents were alive, the holidays would typically be in their farmhouse. And it was an old-fashioned farmhouse on Route 20 in Ohio. Route 20 was, of course, one of the first transcontinental roads. And at that place, it had been a corduroy road. Which is interesting. It wasn't obviously anymore, but there was that whole tradition and history there. And their house was right on that road. And when I say an old farmhouse, it had a big linoleum floor kitchen. It had a pump room, basement with food lockers, not lockers, food cabinets for canned goods and things like that. A cold storage sort of place.
Yeah.
Had a big dining room table, old sideboard, a living room, and then a separate parlor, which was the fashion then.
Right.
And a big, of course, originally it didn't have an indoor bathroom at all, but when they had an indoor bathroom, they had a big four-clawed tub, which I remember just swimming laps in as a kid. Very, very nice. But when we were young, it would, there'd be a big dinner and there'd be too many of us to all be at the same table, so there'd be a kid's table, an adult's table.
Right.
And then we would go out and play, and depending on the time of the year, that meant either we might be playing softball out in the yard, and the yards were big and great big trees, silver maples and elm trees, so that there was lots of room to set up a softball diamond or to play touch football or whatever else. But if it was winter, sort of Thanksgiving, Christmas, then we'd play in the barn. And the barn became a wonderful place for us to hang out. I mean, we raised livestock and things like that, but there was a haymow where we built forts out of hay bales and elaborate tunnels and chambers and multi-storied things, which was really fun. And we had a space that we cleared for a very large basketball court with baskets at each end, so you could play full court with bare light bulbs hanging to light it during the day. And well, stop for a minute. There's something else I wanted to mention.
Okay, so continue talking. Just continue.
Well, let me back up with the barn. When my father was still alive, they would drive in the summer for their vacations out on the farm, go back and visit my grandparents, and they had a 1949 Pontiac, which they were very proud of at that time, and my dad built a platform so that the back seat, where the feet your feet would normally be, you could sleep. So the kids would be in the back seat, and the kids were basically John and myself at that point, obviously, and they would drive. My guess is they must have. Well, they go along the Mohawk Trail because we would always stop. There, kind of a semi amusement park on the Mohawk Trail that we would be treated to on the way, and I'm sure we stopped at a little motel to break the drive because you didn't have the super highways that kind of moved as quickly. When we would be out there, then it would be summertime, and we would be working at the farm, but working the way city kids would work on the farm. So it was fun to us, but we would be learning about the experience. But then as we were there more frequently, my dad had died now, but just before we still had to move out there to do that. We had to build a house, and so it took a couple of years. But at that point, we would visit in the summer, and my Uncle Bob would buy livestock for John and me, and so he might buy 60 or so head of sheep, and we would raise those sheep during the summer, and then he would take them to market, and we would go with him to the old auctions and listen to that, and sell the sheep, and then he would pay us the profits of this. And I still remember, and as a kid, I never understood the auctioneers or how much money what they were bidding actually was going to translate into. Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting at that old kitchen table with my Uncle Bob and John, and he said he had our money in $1 bills and gave sort of dealt out $5 to each of us and said, is that enough? And we were just delighted. We'd never seen $5 before, because that was a time when you know your allowance might be 25 cents,
right? And, exactly.
And he said, "You sure you don't want more?" Then he started to keep going, and I remember we had something over $40, and I just felt independently wealthy. But it was a great experience of raising the livestock and learning that. And then, of course, as we then moved out there, we always raised livestock, and I, you know, would use the barn for those purposes. My grandparents weren't really farming anymore, and so the barn was there, and so we would always, and I would commute from there to Bowling Green State, so it meant that every morning we were up early doing chores, and in the evening we were doing chores. But it was also a source of income for us. I don't mean for us as a family. I mean more for me as an individual.
That sounds marvelous. It really does.
It was.
Tell me about school.
Well, I started at Glover Elementary School in Marblehead, Massachusetts. We lived on Leicester, and it's spelled Leicester in the British sort of way, but on Leicester street, I think it was, in Marblehead.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could walk to the elementary school, which I did every day. Mm-hmm. There were playgrounds. At the bottom of the street, there were wonderful vacant fields, overgrown vacant fields where my playmates and I would play. And we were about 5 or 6 blocks from the ocean.
Mm.
And from Preston Beach. So in the summer, my summers had, when I was not in Ohio, had a towel around my neck and I was on the bike and would be down at Preston Beach.
Nice. Do you eat a lot of ice cream? Do you remember? I'm curious because I always associate the best ice cream with Massachusetts.
We used to eat saltwater
oh,
taffy,
right.
and fried clams mm-hmm. were big then. The best ice cream we had was actually in Ohio because we would make the hand cranked old homemade ice cream.
Yeah,
would be a real treat. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in school. Your early years in school starting in Massachusetts.
I would have been in about the third grade when my father died.
Yeah.
And I don't think we got to move to Ohio until 6th or 7th grade, somewhere in there. I'm sure I was in Massachusetts still for the 4th and 5th grade because I remember the teachers there. And now my mother is trying to figure out how to raise me.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent a lot of time at the YMCA. I learned to shoot pool really well, and that's been a lifetime enjoyment of mine and an occasional source of income.
Mm-hmm.
And to swim and to do all the other things you do at a Y, be in Boy Scouts and things like that. And then we moved out to Ohio. When we moved to Ohio, and let's say I was either the 6th or 7th grade, so roughly that time, I was completely out of place because I was sent to school not in jeans but in gabardines, and I didn't know how to dress the part. My mother didn't know how to do it either. She wasn't paying attention to that. So for a long time, I think basically the time there, I was very ill at ease in school.
Mm-hmm.
The school was, the junior high was about a mile or two from the house. But I think we used the bus to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Rode bikes on unusual occasions. But the high school was Troy Lucky High School in Lucky, Ohio. Lucky, Ohio would have been about, spelled with an E-Y.
Okay.
Would have been about 5 or 6 miles south of our house. And I definitely rode the bus there. I had a... and again, I was not a particularly good student, and I was not at all gregarious. But I ran into a wonderful teacher named Helen Rolfes, and she taught. She seemed, of course, ancient, and my guess is at that time she was 45. But she seemed really ancient,
right?
And she taught me Latin, but also taught geometry and algebra.
Hmm.
And for reasons I don't fully understand, because when I say I wasn't a good student, I was a C sort of student. And and Helen Rolfes came to my mother and said, "We're just not capable of challenging Steve."
Hmm.
Now, how and why she discerned that, I have no idea.
Interesting.
It was interesting in retrospect. And so my mother... sent me to a prep school called Cranbrook in Bloomfield Hills outside of Detroit, Michigan. A beautiful, wonderful place where a lot of my appreciation for aesthetics and architecture were derived from Cranbrook. And so I was at Cranbrook for 2 years. And Cranbrook was a very good school. I mean, just really a super good school.
Now, was this during junior high or
high school?
High school. Okay.
What happened was I was at Troy Luckey High School as a freshman and sophomore.
Oh, right. Okay.
Then I went to Cranbrook.
Okay.
But I mean, the high school there was not a very good high school. It was a typical rural high school. And so Cranbrook said I had to go back to being a freshman, go back to being a sophomore. So I lost a year. Spent 2 years at Cranbrook. Again, I had a wonderful time, and it really influenced me mightily and taught me lots of good things, but I was not a particularly good student. And John then joined me at Cranbrook. And then both of us, at their invitation, left. So I am literally a high school dropout because I did not graduate from high school, even though I had 4 years of high school and in effect had enough to get my general equivalency and to go to university. I went to Bowling Green State, which was about 17 miles from our house. And so I would commute the drive to and from campus every day.
Okay.
And I should say the first summer when I went to summer orientation, I sought out the philosophy department, and I went in and I told them I was going to be a philosophy major. That's because of the chance to have studied philosophy at Cranbrook, which very few high school age students could study philosophy at that time. So I've always loved philosophy, and it was kind of clear that that's what I wanted to do, and so I pursued it ever
since.
That's
so interesting. I at that time, I don't even recall philosophy being an option in high school.
Mm. It wouldn't have been, and certainly not at Troy Luckey.
Right, or I went to a public high school.
Yeah, sure, it wouldn't have been, no.
That's interesting.
Yeah, good.
Were your first philosophy teachers particularly interesting too, or was it just the subject?
The subject was. I enjoyed the questions. I really enjoyed the questions. And I've always, that's what I've always liked about philosophy, more than the answers, is the questions. And the professor there Cranbrook is an Episcopalian school, and he was an Episcopalian priest named Father Young, if I remember correctly. And he was just a really good teacher and chose good texts, and I enjoyed the. And these are obviously introductory philosophy courses, but I enjoyed them, and it's what I wanted to do. And, of course, at that time, you didn't really worry very much about getting a job. So it wasn't as if that choice was going to compromise my ability to earn a living. Getting a baccalaureate degree was sort of the entree into the workforce, so I wasn't worried about that.
That's very interesting. So, in college, you got into philosophy right away. What else about college? And I'm thinking of the times, the years we're talking about now.
I went to Bowling Green State in 1964.
Yeah.
Excuse me, 1960, and graduated in 1960.
Yeah, so we're talking about the 60s, which is
the
quite
early
a time.
60s, though.
Yes.
Early 60s. And this is the time of the Kingston Trio and Peter, Paul, and Mary, and sort of folk music. I was, again, not a particularly accomplished student. I I got on academic probation one semester. But I really enjoyed the college experience. And as I said, I'm living at home, commuting back and forth. So I wasn't very much involved in collegiate activities or things of that sort. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, I met my wife Susan at Bowling Green School.
Aha, uh-huh, right.
And that was the summer after my sophomore year. She was a year ahead of me, so it was summer before her senior year. She was a very good student, unlike myself, and we met in a modern poetry class. And she was working several jobs. Her home was Urbana, Ohio, which was about 100 miles south of Bowling Green State. She lived on campus, was very active and very involved in things, was an Alpha Z, a member of the Alpha Z sorority, as I said, working several different jobs, was performing in theater, was dating a number of guys, and so that was a very nice summer. And to leap ahead, I'm not sure, it must have been that summer, I remember taking Susan home to meet my family, and I had not, I don't know if I'd ever brought a woman home to meet the family yeah. before. So it was a bit of an event, and we were all trying to figure out how this actually worked. That is, my mother was trying to figure out how this actually worked. So she served a wonderful, this would have been Sunday dinner, she served a leg of lamb, which we used to often enjoy, leg of lamb, and served it on good china, a big Limoges platter that my grandmother Weber had passed down into the family. Mm-hmm. And while Mom and I were trying to, and I'm sure Susan was trying to figure out how this worked, my younger brothers had no trouble figuring out at all. This was an opportunity. So they were working to make everybody miserable. But one of our favorite stories happened afterwards. In the nature of the time then, after dinner was done, my brothers and I went out to play in the barn, and Susan and Mom were left to clean up lunch and do
right,
the dishes.
Right.
Pre-dishwasher then, I think.
Could have been.
But they were certainly washing dishes.
Yeah.
So, if there was a dishwasher, it was not sort of placed. So,
well, and you wouldn't put
the pots and pans
in there.
Exactly. they were doing the dishes, and the play that Susan had been in that summer was Barefoot in Athens. She played the role of Theodote, and Theodote was the mistress of Socrates. My mother, as they were at a double sink, and she was washing and Susan was drying, passed the Limoges platter to Susan and said, "So, tell me about yourself. All Steve has said is that you're a prostitute." Which Susan very much appreciated. It's just great. And my mother had a wonderful sense of humor.
That's marvelous. And the Limoges plate didn't drop.
Yes, that's what Susan is most proud of in this story.
That's a great story. Yeah. Yeah. That's a great story. And so you met Susan in college, and that began to shape.
Yes, it did. She was, as I said, a very successful student, graduated at the top of her class, got two different degrees, top of her class in education. She got a BS in education and a BA in American Studies and English. And that was very unusual at that time. In fact, it was, and of course she did it all in 4 years while she was working all these different jobs and things. She had a great critic teacher, because as the top of her class, she got to her choice of the best critic teachers, and hers was named Miss Galvin, and Miss Galvin was a very important influence on Susan. And Susan went off, now it's my senior year, Susan went off to teach in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, teaching English and speech in I think it was Parcells Elementary School. Middle School. And it was at that time, and this is one of the stories I like, that she dumped me for a football player.
Oh.
Yes, exactly. It was the classic struggle of the philosopher against the football player. And so for about a year, maybe over a year, I was still on campus, and Susan was in Detroit and dating this football player. So it wasn't until then I graduated that Susan and I got back together again and started dating again, but very tangentially, the way these relationships sometimes can be mm-hmm. reignited.
Mm-hmm.
I went off, then she's still teaching in Grosse Pointe. I went off to the University of Colorado.
Yes.
To the philosophy department there.
I see that.
So it would be from 64 to 66.
Right.
But from 64 to 65, I was in Colorado. She was still she lived in Detroit and taught in Grosse Pointe. So, but then I persuaded her to come out and visit me in Colorado for Thanksgiving. And I proposed to her at Christmas time that year, and then we were married the next summer and drove out to Colorado. And so the 1965-66 year, we both lived in student housing at the University of Colorado. Very, very nice time. And then I was accepted to the PhD program at Notre Dame. And so after a year in Colorado, we went to Notre Dame. She began teaching in Elkhart. She taught that year in a suburb outside of Denver. Then we moved to, we didn't actually move to South Bend. We moved to Elkhart, Indiana,
mm-hmm.
Where she taught in Elkhart high schools. And I taught at Notre Dame as a graduate assistant while I was doing my doctorate. And that, of course, was almost the extremes of the educational experience. I mean, she was literally refereeing food fights in the cafeteria, and I was teaching valedictorians under the Golden Dome. I mean, it was really sort of the whole spectrum of education. And of course, part of the thing that was really tragic about much of what Susan dealt with is you had high school students whose parents had never graduated from high school, who had no intent of graduating from high school themselves, were waiting to be 16 so they could drop out of school.
Mm.
So that was a difficult area, and it was a town then that was a hard scrabble sort of place, made trailers and made con trumpets, among other things, were made there, other musical instruments.
And what was Susan teaching? History or English?
No. Or? Speech and English primarily.
Okay.
And at that time, she was also the debate coach.
Ah.
And she had been very successful public speaker herself, winning a champion at Ohio State when she was a high school student. And so she taught speech and taught debate and often would be with her debate team on a weekend because they'd have to go off and debate someplace.
Nice. Well, it's okay. They weave it, you know. Okay, well, let me put it on.
You were observing that Susan and I are very much of a team.
Yes.
And that's really true. And I think it's been one of the secrets both to the just sheer joy of living that we share, but also to the success that I've had, because as I've had a chance to work with university presidents all over the United States, often university presidents have spouses that are not themselves assets, and sometimes spouses that are not interested, and sometimes spouses that are liabilities, and of course sometimes spouses that are dead. So for me to have had such a gregarious spouse who works the room better than I do and hears all the things that I sometimes don't hear has been extraordinarily helpful.
That's wonderful.
And the other thing is, as I said, Susan's discipline is communications.
Mm-hmm.
So from the time we were beginning an administrative career and I was beginning to speak publicly, Susan would critique my speeches. And you know, to this day, when we drive home, mm-hmm. Susan is... So Susan has... we joke about the fact that we've almost reversed roles, because Susan was a cheerleader, very gregarious, outgoing, all those qualities. I was a complete nerd, introverted, and as life has moved along, she has transformed me into a much more social creature than I ever was. And she is now relishing the privacy of, in recent years she's been able to spend summers in Maine, and is relishing the prospect of retirement and fewer social obligations.
Oh, that's marvelous, and to see how that happens in terms of the effect on each other, that's wonderful. Because certainly now I know that from what I hear and what I've read, you are known for the way you communicate and relate to and involve everybody.
That's absolutely Susan. That's absolutely Susan. Yeah.
Well, and Susan, as you know, is my name as well. It's such a popular name from that era.
Yes, although as I'm sure you've noticed also, it has so many various formats.
Oh yes.
So, and Susan prefers Susan, as I take it you do as well.
Well, it's either Susan or Susie.
Yes. Well, Susan prefers Susan.
Okay.
She really does, and it is it annoys her when people will call her Suzanne or other formations of that name.
Yeah. Well, I've gone through different stages. In high school, I was called Sue.
Yes. Susan does not like Sue.
I don't either, but I don't know why. I just don't. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think Susan was definitely my adult name.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in college and then in graduate school, as you continued with your emphasis in philosophy, tell me more about that and how you selected your dissertation topic and how that all evolved.
Well, let me say a couple things about that. First of all, as I've said several times, I wasn't a very good student. I became a good student when I started dating Susan. Not dating Susan, when I was married to Susan.
Okay.
It was an interesting thing that I think I got serious about life and my work and my studies when Susan and I got married. But back to about philosophy, I want to back up to meeting Susan's parents. I talked about Susan meeting my mother.
Yes.
and as I said, Susan lived about 100 miles south of Bowling Green State, did not have a car at Bowling Green State. I had applied for admission to Wittenberg, which is a seminary in
mm-hmm.
Springfield.
Mm-hmm.
I am an atheist. So it wasn't that I felt any great calling. I enjoyed the relation to philosophy and the chance to pursue these questions.
Okay.
So in that process, I would I would lie to Susan, and I'd say, I'm going down for an interview at Wittenberg. Would you like a ride down to say hello to your parents? And so that would mean we'd have 2 hours together in the car going down. I would meet her parents. I would help put screen windows up or whatever. Yeah. That way I could ingratiate myself to her parents. And Wittenberg was in Springfield, Ohio, and that's about probably 30 miles away from Urbana. And so then I would excuse myself to go to my meeting at Wittenberg. I would, in fact, go downtown and shoot pool, come back 3 or 4 hours later, pick up Susan, and we would drive back to Bowling Green. One of the stories Susan likes to tell is that after first meeting her parents, her father, who was a small-town businessman, said, well, he's a nice enough guy, I suppose, but what does a philosopher do? And it's a fair enough question if you're living in the real world. I should back up and say a little bit about Susan's parents. Her father worked for the old Morris Five and Dime stores and ran a Five and Dime store, and then ran when that folded. Went to work as a foreman at Grimes. And Grimes Industries made most of the airplane lighting in the free world during World War II. This is not that long after World War II. And so it was a major aircraft lighting company right there in Urbana, Ohio, where Susan had gone to school and, as I said, had been a cheerleader and had all those memories. Susan's father, I don't think he graduated from high school. I know her mother didn't. They grew up in Indiana, Susan has two brothers, had two brothers, one is since deceased. And there too, in a very typical way for the 1950s, 1960s, they were determined that all three of their kids would go to college, and they all did, Susan among them.
Yeah, that's very, very nice. Well, getting back to philosophy.
Yes. Oh, that's right. I wondered why. I went, as I said, to Bowling Green State as a philosophy major. I never wavered from that. I had two teachers that were particularly good. One was man named Sherman Stanage. Wonderful, great teacher. You know, one of those remarkable teachers that students gravitate towards.
Yeah.
He was, and by this time I had left, but during the late 60s, he was leading protests against the Vietnamese War and was ultimately fired from Bowling Green State for his political activities.
Oh, interesting.
And went off to Northern Illinois, where he finished his career. And I stayed in tangential touch with him through those many years. Another was Robert Goodwin, Goodwin, who taught, among other things, medieval philosophy, and was really while Sherman Stanage was an inspiration and a Pied Piper, Robert Goodwin was really a very good professional mentor. He wrote a book. A commentary on Thomas Aquinas' De Ente et Essentia, and he let me annotate the footnotes for it one summer, as giving me employment. This is the summer between my graduation and going off to graduate school. And he was just a good person kind of helping me develop professionally.
Mm-hmm.
I went then to the University of Colorado into philosophy, although I also studied classics there, and had a good experience. This is now a major philosophy department, unlike Bowling Green State, where you didn't have that many people in the philosophy department. This was really some serious philosophers with national reputations, and I wanted to do my master's thesis on Zabarella. Zabarella is an obscure Renaissance philosopher, and I could not find anybody in the philosophy department there that had the least interest in doing a thesis on Zabarella and in guiding me through one. And so I wasn't able to do Zabarella, and I did instead John of Salisbury. John of Salisbury wrote several books, but he's an 11th century figure. He was the secretary to Thomas à Becket. Interesting man, although probably more interesting to a philosopher than to most people. But in fact, it was not a dissert. It was not a thesis I loved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't something I wanted to do. It was something I could get a faculty member to help me do.
Yeah.
And that was important, because then when I left the University of Colorado to go to Notre Dame,
mm-hmm.
I had learned an important lesson, and I said, I'm not going to do a dissertation on a topic that I'm not interested in, because it's a lot of work.
I
don't want to do that. Yeah. So I went then to Notre Dame. Now, this is a really distinguished philosophy
right.
department, and you know, philosophy is sort of a mainline discipline at Notre Dame. I was interested in medieval philosophy. There were only two places to go. It was either Notre Dame or Toronto. Those were the two best medieval departments on this continent.
Okay.
And I ended up at Notre Dame. Really fine experience. Wonderful, wonderful faculty. And of course, I love the experience of being a graduate student. This is true in Colorado as well, where now all your work is philosophy, as opposed
yes.
to the usual undergraduate experience
yes.
where you're taking a variety of courses. So I had always loved philosophy, and I just ate up that experience.
That's great.
And I had a lot of very, very good teachers. Ernan McMullen for philosophy of science was one that was particularly good. Joseph Bobick. And Joseph Bobick became a real mentor of mine. He was a medievalist. And he became my dissertation director. And what I wanted to do was to write a dissertation that would be interesting
uh-huh.
to me. So I wrote a dissertation on the title is Proofs Plural for the Existence of God, a Meta-Investigation.
Yeah.
Now, what this is, in fact, is a refutation of all the traditional proofs for the existence of God, which was a particular pleasure to write at a place like Notre Dame.
That's
fun.
Wow.
Now, going back to what I said, that would be interesting. And it was interesting. It was just So the dissertation was when it was not hard to get up every morning to be working on that, because I enjoyed the topic and I enjoyed the intellectual give and take with faculty there who were
great.
The best in the business
yeah.
in terms of doing things like that.
That's very exciting.
It was.
Yeah. Wow. And at the time that you were doing that, what was Susan doing?
Susan was teaching in Elkhart.
That's right.
And we were typical young young married folks, and it's not an unusual experience, somehow it seemed like we had more disposable income at that time in our lives than almost any other time. Because, of course, we didn't have children, housing didn't cost very much.
Right.
Recreation was often to go into Chicago, stay at the Palmer House for a weekend, do some theater, visit museums, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very nice, pleasant time of life for both of us.
Yeah, and, okay, you got your doctorate in 1969.
Right.
So you were there during the later 60s.
Yes, yes.
And what was Notre Dame like? What was the impact of what was going on?
Now, of course, we're in the Vietnam
right.
War. There are demonstrations on campus, I shouldn't say daily, probably once a week.
Right.
I remember being in a number of those demonstrations. They're typically demonstrations against military recruitment or against the CIA coming, you know, sort of anti-recruitment demonstrations as well as more broadly based anti-war demonstrations. Sometimes civil rights demonstrations.
Right.
Those were sort of the issues of that,
right.
that time. It was a politically engaged campus, but the political engagement for almost all of the people there, and I don't mean to overstate that, was within a context of their Catholic faith, and so it was sort of a peace and justice theme that led many of them into those demonstrations.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
What about the feminist movement?
We're talking about Notre Dame. At that time, there were not any women at. Well, that's not true. There were no undergraduate women at Notre Dame. There was a St. Mary's, which was a women's college across the street.
Okay.
Now, but there were women in my graduate programs.
Okay.
There were. I want to say that at this time there were probably 25 of us pursuing doctorates. There might have been more that. You know, that I didn't interact with, and I think three of them were women.
Okay, yeah, I just
something else. If
do you
I
want
can.
Me to turn
yeah,
it
yeah, sure.
On?
If you would, just to
all right, let's go.
Because the part of being young marrieds at Notre Dame, and part of being at Notre Dame was football, and one of the things that Susan, 46 years later, has not forgiven me for is that. I remember one fall, a bunch of graduate students after class, we went over to get our season football tickets because you could get very reasonable price for football tickets. And I bought one, not two. I bought one. and because I did not imagine that Susan would be particularly interested, and she was often away coaching and debate on weekends and things like that. But what I had not understood was that football was the major social event of the year among graduate students. And so I didn't make that mistake again.
Uh-huh. Well, that's very interesting because, of course, Notre Dame, everybody
knows. Yeah, it was part of that.
Right.
Part of that tradition, sure.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So after you completed your dissertation, what was the next step?
Well, really, the next step was looking for a job,
mm-hmm.
and that was really not so much after, but during, because,
okay.
of course, that last year, so you begin to go to professional meetings. The American Philosophic Association, you begin to do interviews.
Right.
We very much wanted to be in New England, so we focused our job interviews in the Northeast,
mm-hmm.
And I was really pleased when I got an opportunity to interview at the University of Maine.
Mm-hmm.
So I went off to an interview. Typically, these interviews take place in January, February, and so I fly to Bangor, Maine, and then go to Orono, which is about 10 miles away. And I stay with the chair of the philosophy department and his wife in their home. and I get snowed in. That's probably why I had a chance to get that job, was because I ended up spending, I think, 3 or 4 days with them. I ended up, you know, babysitting for them, all sorts of things
that marvelous.
You had not otherwise expected.
That's
Bob,
great.
Bob and Judy Treadwell, and in fact, we just had a farewell gala a couple weeks ago, and Bob and Judy came from Maine for that gala, and they were very good friends and mentors through that
lovely.
Whole period. So we were offered the job at Maine. I was offered $9,000, and one of the other graduate students had accepted an offer for $9,500 at another university. And of course, I was completely obtuse with regard to cost of living and all those other things. But I had it in my head that I wasn't going to accept an offer for less than $9,500. And so that commenced a long and anxious negotiation, because on the one hand, saying, no, I got to have $9,500. On the other hand, I really wanted to go to Maine. Susan and I were eager to do that. And again, one of those dumb lucky things is that they made the offer at $9,500 and we accepted it. And so then we got in Susan's blue Volkswagen Beetle and drove from South Bend to Orono, Maine. I should back up and say, I at that time was driving, backing up now way to the University of Colorado, I mm-hmm. was driving an MG. It was an MG 1500, which is just a yummy MG between the MG TD and the MGA. It was just produced for a couple of years.
Uh-huh.
Beautiful, beautiful car, which as we got married, we first of all didn't need two cars, and that car didn't make very much sense, and so I sold that car. We used the money to pay off Susan's Volkswagen Beetle, which became our car then for many, many years. But it was a difficult thing to give up that
I
MG.
I can hear it. Yeah.
So Susan and I, as I said, drove to Maine. Took probably 3 days. I think we had, I've forgotten whether we had a trailer behind the car or not, but we probably did. Stopping along the way at a couple of different places. I remember one, we spent a night in Rumford, Maine, and the lady there grew violets and I think also Christmas cactus. And she was really intrigued with the thought that we were going off to start this new adventure. And so she gave us cuttings from these plants, which we had for many, many years. And we went to live in Orono in an apartment in Mr. Kelly's house on Main Street. I got we went into this great old apartment with a big slate sink and instead of
nice.
What you would recognize as faucets, now it had two separate faucets with hoses that came down to a joint nozzle in the middle.
Hmm.
A big old claw foot tub had a fireplace, which is what really attracted us to the place. It was just great. Mr. Kelly lived upstairs. So we got settled there. I had the really good fortune of being with a great philosophy department. Really great. Now, philosophy departments are pretty small. So there were six of us, I think, at that time. But Bob Treadwell was the chair. And he said to me, I'm not going to assign you to any committees for your first year, but you have to come to every meeting of the College of Arts and Sciences and sit next to me, and I'll explain what's going on. And that's why you're doing this interview right now.
Mm.
Because you rarely get a chance to have that sort of window in terms of how universities work. It was Bob Treadwell that started doing that. Now, it also happened that Bob then became the assistant to the president of the University of Maine a couple years later. Also in that department was a man named Ralph Yum, who had been an academic dean. Soon to join the department, not yet, but soon to join the department was Jefferson White, who had also been an academic dean. So I was surrounded with some very savvy colleagues, mm-hmm. and they were really, really helpful in my beginning to understand how universities worked. And I became involved in academic governance, what you would think of today as the University Senate, but there it was called the Council of Colleges. And then one of the things that was for me a very nice experience was after Bob stepped down as assistant to the president, there was another assistant to the president, and when that person was getting ready to leave, the president of the University of Maine, or really the cabinet, was looking for the next assistant to the president, and they sent out letters to about a dozen of us saying, you know, would you consider such a thing? And I wrote back and said, absolutely not. I have integrity. Don't you understand this? My colleagues hastened to assure me that I didn't have integrity. but my interest in how universities work, this was a natural expression of it, which it hadn't occurred to me. It frankly occurred to my colleagues. Huh. And I still have the letter that I wrote saying, no, I'm not interested in this job. And Howard Neville was the name of the president, and to my amazement, he offered me the job, and I remember saying, you know, I really don't understand why, with these other folks that are so good, you want me. And he said, well, you're right, they know more than you do now, but 6 months from now, you'll know more than they would.
That's terrific.
Exactly. And that was true. And it was just great move, wonderful mentor. So
that's great.
Good person to work with. But again, now, you couldn't find a better place to understand a university than being assistant to the president. You see the whole the whole board again. So that was very formative in the whole process.
Okay, so you're in Maine, and this is in the, we're talking about the 1970s now?
No. Well, yes, it is the 1970s.
1970, yes. End of 60s, 1970s. And so I was just thinking, did you get involved also in the state, I mean, the interaction between, just as you have to deal with here in California, the state and
yes,
the budget
absolutely.
And all those things?
Yes, absolutely, I did. I should back up and say that we've left out my teaching, and it was a wonderful philosophy department, good colleagues. One of the great things they did was they had a course called Philosophy in Modern Life, which was taught, this was a large course of like 200 students, and it was team taught, and they would put two of us together, typically a more senior colleague and a younger person like myself, and we would together choose a topic that we were interested in having a sustained discussion about. So it was like a protracted debate.
Nice.
It was very, very nice. And for me, again, very formative, because I got to see some really experienced people, and I got to learn a lot about that. I was a good teacher. I was brought in part to do medieval philosophy and metaphysics and things like that, which is what was consistent with my graduate work. But before long, I had a chance to do a course in existentialism, just subbing for somebody who was on sabbatical, and I loved the existentialism course. And unlike it's very hard to get students terribly enthusiastic about Thomas Aquinas or the Middle Ages,
mm-hmm.
but they were, particularly at that time, incredibly enthusiastic about existentialism.
Yeah.
So that was just a sheer pleasure. And another part of the thing which was pleasant, this was going back even to graduate school, that was a time of coffee houses.
Oh, right.
And I would occasionally go to coffee houses not to read poetry, but to read philosophy, and by and large existential philosophy.
Uh-huh.
So Nietzsche, Kierkegaard, people like that, Sartre. But as I said, I was good at what I did there. I got that, as you mentioned earlier, the Outstanding Humanities Teacher Award. That was part of a FIPSE grant that funded those awards. And I received a cash prize of $500, with which I bought a table saw, which I'm right now packing up to take to Maine, and a Wilson T3000 tennis racket, which was hot stuff then.
Are you a tennis player?
I was. I was a tennis player. I'm not now, but I was, and enjoyed that very much. So I was good at teaching, which was one of the reasons why it hadn't occurred to me that my avocation of administration and the university was where I might want to ultimately end up. And even then, when you go to be assistant to the president, that's not really a career move. That's a dabble.
Mm-hmm.
But that dabble then led at one point to becoming a dean at another university. And that's sort of where you declare to the to the administrator in that move. Because when you're an assistant to the president, you can always go back to the faculty and people can forgive you for that lapse.
Well, but that's a great opportunity to decide.
Oh, it is. That's really exactly the way it served for me, was a chance to see that process.
Yeah. That's very interesting, because I find it interesting. You know, when you look at a CV, you see dates and you see what you did, but it's so enlightening to understand the process of what really happened so that this came about.
Well, also at this time, now, as you said, we are in the 70s.
Right.
This is the time of the Cambodian invasion. Campuses are being, this time of Kent State, campuses are being shut down, boycotted. There's a wonderful photo I have of some colleagues and me leading a march through Orono, an anti-war march. One of my first experiences with politics was about a dozen of us signed a letter to the Bangor Daily News, a full-page ad kind of letter, calling for Nixon's impeachment. Something which I'm quite proud of, because this was sort of pre the general call for his impeachment. It's way pre Watergate. But I was amazed that some of my colleagues then didn't want to talk to me anymore. It was an interesting thing. It's not that it bothered me, but it surprised me. It just hadn't occurred to me. But I mean, there were literally in this small town people that would cross over to the other side of the street to avoid saying hello to me. But that was the nature of those times in terms of the war was very divisive on campuses.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh yes. Yes.
Sure.
Can I do that?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, I'm going to do that. Tell me a little bit about Orono and where it is and what it's like there.
Well, the first thing to understand is it's a small town of about, I'm guessing, 12 to 15,000 people, of whom 9,000 are students.
Oh.
So it's a small, small college town,
About
10 miles north of Bangor. But the more important thing to know is it's a land-grant campus. So the Morrill Act, which established the land-grant universities in 1865, I think it was, set up that expression of the Morrill Act in Maine was not unlike many other states at that time, which was it allowed the sale of lands to raise the money to develop campuses. And they were largely looking to be applied. The Morrill Act felt that we needed college-based citizenry that was not just preparing for the ministry or something like that. So the University of Maine at Orono was the land-grant campus, which is to say it was the big campus within the system. There were other little campuses spread around, but it was the kind of campus that could support a philosophy department, did research, was involved in agricultural extension activities around the state, all those kinds of things.
Very nice. So as you proceeded going on into doing more with administration, what were the next steps that led you towards here?
Well,
I see
the next step was I went to
New York.
But as I said, I became a dean at Fairfield University.
Ah, that's next.
And I was there for 5 years. Our kids were now in elementary school.
Oh.
Our kids were both born in Maine.
I was just going to say, let's go back a minute. Tell me about the kids.
Yes, I should. Rick was born on July 1st, 1971. And Matt came along 3 years later. So we have two sons, both born in Maine. And I should say that for us, Maine is home. People often wonder about that. They ask if we're from Maine, and the answer is no. But Maine is where we develop those early professional relationships with other young colleagues. Mm-hmm. It's where our kids were born, where we owned our first home, all those sorts of things. As life has unfolded, we were able to buy some land on the coast of Maine.
Oh.
It then took us a while to pay that off, and then we built a home there. And that's been constant for us while we moved around the rest of the country.
Oh, how lovely.
So that's home, and that's home for our kids and for us. So the kids were in, by the time we went to Fairfield, they were in elementary school.
Okay.
Riverside Elementary School, not very far away from our house, walkable from the houses, I guess elementary schools are intended to be.
Yeah.
And the house was not very far from the campus. I should say one of the things my mother did when I went to the University of Maine for that fall, the next spring, toward the spring of 1970, she bought me a bike, a really nice Raleigh 3-speed bike. And because that was the perfect way to get to and from campus. We were still a one-car family and continue to be a one-car family for many, many years. So I would ride to and from campus on my bike. And I just now asked the theater department whether they would want an old 3-speed bike, and they do, to my great pleasure. So I'm going to give them the bike.
Terrific.
Because I still got it.
I'm familiar with that particular bike, too.
Yeah, and they're great old bikes, and that was sort of the academic bike of the time. But when we were in Fairfield, we were about a mile and a half from the campus also, really kind of at the base of the hill. The campus was up on the top of the hill. So I would ride my bike to work every morning up the hill and had that wonderful, delightful feeling of coasting home after work in the evening. It was a very nice kind
That's
of
lovely.
Way to proceed. Again, still a one-car family at that time. I think the car then was a Volare station wagon, to reflect two young kids in suburbia.
Right.
Susan was in Fairfield. Susan was very active in the Mills. She was a docent in the Millstream project. I'll have to check on the exact
name
of
that.
But there's a river that runs along through there, and this is a wonderful program where the school kids are taken out to the river every year for a different kind of curriculum. So the kindergartners, are allowed to sort of see erosion by pouring water in sandboxes.
Nice.
And then the next year they'll be doing something else. The next year, right on up through the whole curriculum. And so Susan would work with those folks. She was also advertising work in New York City, which she enjoyed, because Fairfield's a commuter town from New York City, so it was...
What are the neighboring towns? I'm familiar.
On the east, Bridgeport. On the west, Stamford.
Yeah.
Towns like that.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
It's very nice. So you're right on Long Island Sound.
Right.
But Susan likes to say that she never made much money in her work in advertising, but she was really well dressed. She was. So she would go to and from the city on the train.
Where did she work?
Well, as a couple of different companies, but it was mostly advertising and market research. So she was working as a freelance with different companies. We also gorged ourselves on theater then, because one of the things Maine didn't have as much theater. The first year we were there, we saw 26 plays in the first year. But it wasn't just New York City. It was the Long Wharf Regional Theater. It was the Yale Rep.
Yeah,
so you know, they were all available there.
So
I'm now a young dean at Fairfield University. Fairfield is a Jesuit university.
Oh, I know.
In fact, one of my concerns was when I was called up to ask to come down for an interview, I said, there must be some mistake. I've already got a rejection letter from you. And there was a mistake. I had a rejection letter from them.
Huh.
I said, so before we continue this call, why don't you go back and check your records? But in any event, we went down there. I took that job really as the first time we'd kind of, I mean, we expected to be moving when we were graduate students. So this is the first time we made really a professional move.
Mm-hmm.
Susan very much enjoyed Fairfield, Connecticut. It's a nice place to live.
Very nice location.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I found being a dean really interesting. I was not a Catholic, so I had to kind of understand that culture, but I'd learned some of it from Notre Dame.
Yeah.
One of my first concerns during the interview was that they had looked at my degree from Notre Dame and my dissertation topic and
I was wondering.
Reached the wrong conclusion.
Ah.
So I had to make that clear before we went further.
Interesting.
But that worked out fine, and we had 5 years there, which were very good years. Learned a lot. Deanships are nice jobs because you're really working very directly with students and with faculty and programs, and so I enjoyed it. Then we went off to St. Cloud State University in Minnesota.
Yes.
Now our kids are junior high, high school, well, elementary school and junior high.
Okay.
And St. Cloud is a town of about 40,000 people then. A wonderful place to raise two sons. They could get on their bikes and go anywhere.
Oh, nice.
It was absolutely safe.
Oh, that's great.
Great schools. Minnesota has really, really good schools. A great work ethic, a good social social capital kind of environment. It was just really good place to raise the kids. And we enjoyed that. Susan now was also doing some advertising work. She became the chair of their annual festival there called the Wheels, Wings, and Water Festival. In fact, the first parade we ever were in, sort of riding in a car, I was Susan's date. Susan was the president of this thing, the president's not right, director of it or whatever, and so I was her date, and she was busy waving and doing all these
That's great.
Sort of things. So since then, we've had to be in a number of different parades. Susan is not parade friendly, but but in any event, she was working in advertising with Thieland Advertising at that time, and then she was also teaching at St. Cloud State in the communications department.
Uh-huh.
She had, while we were in Fairfield, she picked up her master's degree in communication.
Oh, great. Yeah.
So there we were living a Minnesota lifestyle. Minnesota is obviously very, very cold in the winter, but people are well adapted to it. So there was downtown a great skate, a little lake, really a big pond, that was frozen, of course, and they would clear the ice, and they had a warming house. And Susan loved to go down there in the evenings while our kids were in the library or someplace else, ice skate, do things like that.
Oh, nice.
Our kids, even in Maine, our kids had played hockey. But by the time we got to St. Cloud, they were already very accomplished swimmers. And so Rick began to swim on the varsity swim team when he was still in junior high. And subsequently Matthew did. And the reason that turned out to be really fortunate for us is, on the one hand, by and large, swimmers are pretty good kids.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, it's an exhausting sport, and if you've got two young males around the house, it's better to have them tired than not. But what became important later on, which we hadn't understood, is when we moved into the presidency in SUNY Oswego, small town, visible job, they had their own identities. So they weren't, you know, they had their own accomplishments as swimmers. So that was really helpful. I mean, very, very helpful to both of them as we went along. But we were in St. Cloud for 4 years. I worked with a president named Brendan McDonald, also a very good mentor. Brendan was a Canadian, and he had come down from Canada to play hockey at St. Cloud State as a student. So he was an alum of St. Cloud State. He had been involved in higher education. He had been a president of another institution before being president at St. Cloud. He was very knowledgeable and experienced, but he also didn't want to be the academic vice president.
Mm.
And this is a case where the chemistry between the president and the chief academic officer is really critical. And he and I just had a very good chemistry, and he was absolutely comfortable letting me run academic affairs, which is one of the things I've tried to do then with the chief academic officers that have worked with me when I've served as president.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that was for Brendan and me a story he used to love to tell was when I was interviewing there. These interviews for such positions are usually 2 or 3 day events, as are the ones that are going on right now for my successor. And in this case, I met him early on in the interview process and went through the campus and everything. But the last thing was going to be a breakfast meeting with him. And we met in a small room in the student union. Their catering staff provided breakfast, and there was a person, you know, taking care of our needs. And we had a very nice and comfortable conversation. And after I left, this young woman who was studying, not just studying communications, but studying nonverbal communications, said, having watched these different candidates, she said, "He's the one you're going to hire." And Brendan said, "Well, that's silly. I don't know which one I'm going to hire." And she said, "No, he's the one you're going to hire, because it's very clear you're comfortable with him." And it was true. I mean, he and I worked very well together.
Isn't that interesting?
But it was, there are a lot of these things where when you get to these positions, you're usually not choosing between competence and incompetence. You're looking for the one that fits, that complements, that you can work with, etc. And Brendan was a very good colleague in that regard, but particularly a good colleague in the sense of letting me do academic affairs and not second-guessing it.
That's terrific.
Yeah. I've been very fortunate in my mentors. Really, well, very fortunate.
And it's so great to have you sharing this about mentors, because it's so relevant in all of our lives.
Absolutely, yeah.
It really is. Yeah. And as you mentioned, you know, the relationships with the other couples in Maine or whatever, in Connecticut, did you form friendships there too? Or
yes, but you know, that's an interesting thing to talk about, because when we were in Maine and forming those friendships, we had no administrative authority over anybody.
Oh,
and
that's interesting.
Susan and I often remind ourselves there was an mm-hmm. evening in after we'd been in Fairfield, Connecticut for maybe 6 or 7 months, in which Susan said, "We don't have any friends anymore." And of course, part of it's because we left, and so we're just making new friends. And part of it was that we're in that process of trying out friends and finding that they don't fit.
Mm-hmm.
But also, we were coming to grips with the fact that our administrative authority changed as our relationship with people.
I understand that.
And so the same thing would carry on in Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
We had friends whose kids were also swimmers, so we had those relationships.
Okay.
We had neighbors.
Right.
We had those relationships. But they were quite different than the kinds of initial friendships that you make under different circumstances.
Yeah, I understand that. That's interesting. Sure. Yeah. Can we go to Oswego?
Right.
Okay, so why don't I turn it on? And
one of the things about being an academic vice president is there's one academic vice president on every campus,
mm-hmm.
and there's one president on every campus. And most presidents come up through academic affairs, being chief academic officers, most meaning probably 80 to 90%. So it means that chief academic officers are sort of presidents in waiting.
Oh.
I mean, now, you know, there are obviously exceptions, but I was very fortunate to have in Brendan McDonald a person who saw me as a president in waiting.
Mm-hmm.
And to give you a sense of that, just as I was talking about how Bob Treadwell would sit with me and explain what was going on in
right.
the meetings, there's a group called ASCU, the American Association of State Colleges and Universities, a group that I later became the chair of that you mentioned when our interview began.
Right.
At that time, there was a man named Alan Oster who was the president of ASCU. And this is an association of the presidents of public universities in the United States. And Brendan was active in ASCU, and he invited Alan to come to campus and to make some remarks about public higher education, you know, that sort of thing. But he said, "Steve, I want you to drive down to the airport and pick up Alan, because that'll give you 2 hours with him, and he needs to know who you are,
uh-huh.
and you need to know who he is."
Mm-hmm.
And it was just such a perceptive thing to do. It was a wonderful thing to do. Al and I became good friends. Then when it was time for me to start thinking about applying for presidencies, Brendan suggested, you know, why don't you the next time you're in Washington, stop by, talk with their headhunters, not about any particular job, but just make sure they all know who you are, show them your resume, let them critique it. See, really good, helpful suggestions. And so there came a time then that we were ready to look for a presidency. I only spent 4 years as a chief academic officer. Now, part of the reason for that is that I had opportunities to pursue presidencies. But part of the reason, frankly, is that's the hardest job on campus. It's much harder than a presidency. And I marvel at, in our case, Nancy Marlin, who's our chief academic officer. That's a genuinely demanding job, and it's a job in which you get very little public reinforcement. Most people don't understand. Presidencies, you get lots of public reinforcement and status. So I was fortunate there again to have a really good mentor who was looking out for my interest and saying, you need to meet some of these people and do things like that.
That's very interesting. Would you like to, maybe you'll do this later, but I'd like to hear more about what makes it so difficult, that role.
Yes. First of all, it's a role that controls a major portion of the expenditures of the university. In terms of what we call the general fund budget, which kind of runs the normal operations, separating out, you know, food service and residence halls, but the normal academic university operations, you probably have 75 to 80% of the whole show as chief academic officer. You have the most politically volatile part of the university because you get votes of no confidence from faculty members. You don't get them typically from other employees. So it's far more politically charged and politically sensitive, and the issues with collective bargaining and things like that tend to bear there in a different way than they do in others. But it's also the place that makes decisions about promotion and tenure, makes decisions about hiring. All those are pretty consequential decisions.
Right.
Says, well, we've got the capacity here to hire 20 more faculty members next year. Mm-hmm. And that decision would be made with the president. You sort of agree, okay, we can do 20 more faculty. But where you put those is pretty much yours, your decision. At least that's the way Brendan and I did it. Now, in that circumstance, you need 60 positions, but you've only got 20. So you've got to decide, well, it's more important that we put a position over here in economics than over there in chemistry.
Yeah.
Or vice versa. But so those are tough decisions.
Right.
The same thing is true in terms of most of the admission decisions are ultimately done in academic affairs, student admissions or student denials. So you have those issues. And you're putting out fires. So it's a good job for people with a short attention span, as is presidency. So there's a lot of stuff going on, but the stuff there is often negative, while in a presidency, this stuff is often positive. I talk about myself as an institutional hood ornament, but that's the nature of a presidency. So you get to, as a presidency, you get back to what brought you into higher education in the first place, which is you get to work with students. I mean, last night I was with presidential scholars that are about to be graduating. Recently I've been with some Guardian scholars. These are very satisfying moments.
Yes.
And a chief academic officer typically doesn't get, because that person's busy putting out fires and reviewing promotion tenure documents and all that sort of stuff.
Okay, that clarifies it very well.
Oh, what a good question.
Okay, should I ask it?
Sure.
Okay. So are you still teaching philosophy during this time?
I taught philosophy as a dean. I would teach one course a year through extended studies. Extended studies is a way you often hire adjuncts and you're teaching evening courses. And I would do it without compensation. And I taught less frequently, but only very occasionally, at St. Cloud State. And I missed teaching in both those cases. When I went to Oswego, I think I taught two or three courses during the whole time I was there. Maybe not even that, maybe two. But see, at this point now, this is not the best use of your time. It's more of a personal indulgence to do those courses. But
I see.
But that's what the university is paying me for.
Mm-hmm.
So while it's personally satisfying, it's just not fair to the taxpayers of New York or subsequently of California for me to be doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But in the time I've been here at San Diego State, I've only taught one regular course, and I did that when the philosophy department was without a person to teach philosophy of religion. They hadn't anybody else teach it that year, and so I said I'd be happy to do it. But by and large, I just don't get a chance to do that anymore.
Okay. I notice here that you were the interim provost for academic affairs, State University of New York system in Albany, and that was 1995-1996, which is during the same time frame that you're at Oswego, and that kind of confused
me. It is.
Me.
But, well, let me back up, because we've talked about St. Cloud State.
Okay.
And Brendan's support.
Okay.
And then I get hired to be the president at SUNY Oswego. This is a very nice thing. Susan's busy doing her work. In fact, when I was hired there, she was at a conference in Tacoma, Washington. So we found out about this on the phone. This is part of the State University of New York. There's a local group called the College Council that recommends the president to the chancellor of the system. There are 64 campuses in the SUNY system.
Okay.
And so the chancellor can't be conducting searches. But the chancellor meets those finalists and blesses them. The chancellor was a person named Bruce Johnstone from Minnesota, previously the president of SUNY Buffalo, the College of Buffalo as opposed to the University of Buffalo, became a very, very good friend and also a good mentor and supporter. But we traveled to Oswego. The president there had been Virginia Radley, was my predecessor. She was the first female president in the whole 64 campus system of SUNY.
I remember the name.
Remarkable woman.
Mm-hmm.
A woman who was very uncomfortable in the presidency, but I think took it on because there had to be a female president and she was in a position to do it. So she did it more, I think, as a statement than as something she personally enjoyed.
Interesting.
She was single. She lived in a big old house, which we then lived in ourselves, on the shore of Lake Ontario. The SUNY Oswego campus is north of Syracuse, probably roughly 30 miles north of Syracuse, right on Lake Ontario, right on the shore of Lake Ontario. Mm. Beautiful,
beautiful,
beautiful setting. Big old house built by the founding president, President Sheldon,
mm-hmm.
And built in 1857, as a matter of fact, even before the campus was founded.
Mm.
The campus then became the area, probably 700 acres around his house. So there's that old house right on there. But she was a single woman alone in this big, dark, old house on the edge of a campus. And when I first toured the house, there was a rifle laying across the television set and a shotgun standing up in the corner. And that was, I'm told, the way she entertained, because she wanted people to know that she had guns there. And that, I presume, was because she felt deeply uncomfortable and vulnerable in that setting. Interesting enough, when I was interviewed for the presidency at Oswego, the first question I was asked was, do you carry a gun? Well, that's because Virginia did carry a gun. She wanted everybody to know she carried a gun. But that goes back to, this is a difficult role, and a woman who...
That's fascinating.
Is a fascinating woman. Wonderfully intelligent, articulate, capable woman, but thrusting herself into a role she did not enjoy.
I know her name is familiar to me. So yeah,
it is, because she's one of the earlier female presidents. And
wow, that's really something.
So we were in Oswego for 7 years,
yeah.
And that was a very good experience. And I was in no hurry to leave Oswego. At least I didn't feel I was in a hurry to leave Oswego. But on the other hand, there's a natural half-life to these processes. And the campus was prospering, and we were doing well. And Bruce Johnstone, the chancellor, became seriously ill. And before long, there was a new chancellor named Tom Bartlett. And both of these people are they play important roles, both as friends and mentors, but then they show up later in the story. And I remember saying to Susan, Bartlett's going to call me and ask me to become the interim provost. Now, I have no idea how I knew that. And, of course, I didn't know it, but I just somehow intuited. And I hadn't spent any time with Bartlett. But I knew that Bruce thought highly of my work, and I presumed that Bartlett, needing now a provost, would ask Bruce. And sure enough, a couple days later, the phone rings, and it's Tom Bartlett saying, I'd like you to come down and talk to me about being the interim provost. And I did that, and a couple days later, the phone rang. He said, I'd like you to be the interim provost. I'd like you to start immediately. And I was down in Albany probably within 48 hours in a new job.
Mm-hmm.
And here again, I was very fortunate in my mentors, because Tom Bartlett had been the chancellor of the Alabama system. He had been the chancellor of the Oregon system.
Mm.
He was a very experienced guy. He was older. I think by the time I met him, he was in his late 60s. This was a very tumultuous time in SUNY because the person that hired Bartlett was Mario Cuomo.
He was hired
when Mario Cuomo... Now, Mario Cuomo was running for his fourth term as governor.
Right.
It never occurred to Mario Cuomo that he wouldn't be reelected. An interesting phenomenon.
I remember that.
But of course, he wasn't reelected. Now, what was interesting about that is that Cuomo was always slow about filling vacancies on the board, not just the SUNY board, but most boards. I happen to know that because the person that did his appointments was an alum of SUNY Oswego. And when he was not reelected, it turned out that there were like seven vacancies on the board. And under New York statutes, the governor appoints the chair of the board. So virtually overnight, the board flipped. And I don't mean flipped politically, although it happened to flip from a Democratic governor to a Republican governor.
Yeah.
But it flipped from an experienced board. Boards are designed not to flip. They're designed to have 7 or 8 year terms.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get to come on aboard and understand how the operation works over time, there's some continuity. In the case of New York, the continuity was broken. You had a new group of trustees in power that had very different philosophies, but that, in fact, didn't even know what the questions were. They happened to have answers, but they didn't know what the questions were. So it was a difficult time. Tom was just spectacularly patient for a long time. He thought he could help these new trustees understand what the university was and what its role was in the state. So that proved ultimately to be a false hope, and they were busy driving him out, and eventually did drive him out. Mm-hmm. But when you ask about the chronology, that eighth year in New York was a year that I was down in Albany. So originally I was asked to come down for the fall semester and took an apartment in Albany to do that. But then before long I was asked if I'd stay for the whole year. And I said, well, I'm not going to stay for the whole year and commute back and forth to Oswego every weekend. So we need to bring Susan down here, and we need obviously a more than a one-bedroom apartment to make that work. So we did that. I stayed for the year. And now my very happy time in Oswego had been broken by this experience. Yeah. And it sort of freed me up to be looking for something else or considering something else. Also, my credentials had changed, because now I was a system officer,
yes,
chief academic officer of the largest system in the country,
yes,
which gave me a bunch of experiences I would not have had as the president of SUNY Oswego.
Right.
So then, remind me to talk about Deborah Stanley in a minute. But then I was enjoying this work, but it was obviously an interim.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was thinking about what I want to do. And then I was approached by a headhunter to ask if I would be interested in this position. And the truth was, I didn't know, and mm-hmm. I didn't know very much about California. And California universities have a reputation of hiring people from California, and that folks east of the Rockies don't often get these positions. So I didn't think it was very real, mm-hmm. frankly. Barry Munitz was the chancellor of California State University system at the time. And what I presume happened then was in looking for who could do this job, Barry called SUNY, because SUNY would have the biggest farm team of presidents in the country. And Tom Bartlett said to Barry, you ought to look at Steve Weber. Well, then the interesting thing that happened was then Barry called Bruce Johnstone, now recovering from his illness, and Bruce said the same thing. So I had two folks who had been the chancellors in that system that both recommended me, which I think is what put me in a position mm-hmm. of being seriously considered by Barry. Plus, now I had the system experience.
Mm-hmm.
I need to interrupt before I get back to Deborah.
Okay.
I need to say another thing.
Sure.
Part of the challenge of San Diego State, and we'll have to return to this later, but just in this context, is mm-hmm. we're very different than many of the campuses in the CSU system. Now, every one of these campuses is different.
Right.
But when you're chancellor of the system and you're trying to make decisions that serve the system, those decisions often don't serve San Diego State because we're very different. So,
right.
So there's always a tension between the system and this campus. Roberta Actinson, who was the chair of the board at the time, asked me one time why Charlie Reed and I fight so much. And I said, because we're both doing our job.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's exactly right.
Uh-huh.
So I mention this because my predecessor, Tom Day,
yes,
had also had some system experience, and I think was originally perceived as a person who would be sympathetic to the system and would not be such a fierce advocate for the campus.
Mm.
That proved to be false expectation.
Mm-hmm.
His predecessor, Brage Golding, was exactly the same, was perceived, or at least thinks he was perceived by the system, as a person who would be more compliant. Also, false expectation.
Right.
And I'm absolutely certain I was perceived to be that, because there I was a
How
system officer, et cetera. Yeah. And that's right now, when you talk to people on campus, that's one of the concerns is, how will the next president handle the relationship between the campus and its own integrity
mm-hmm.
versus the system and its needs?
Right.
And that's a job that this person has to handle. So.
And both President Golding and President Day spoke a lot about
this. Of course. Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Deborah Stanley.
Oh, I want to go back to that because it's something that when I went to SUNY Oswego, I had to find an assistant to the president, and I interviewed two or three, maybe four or five people, and none of them were right, and then into my office came Deborah Stanley, who was an attorney. Taught in the School of Business, taught business law and things like that. And she was spectacularly good, so that within a half hour, I'd ceased interviewing her and was trying to sell her on the job.
Oh.
And there again, a lot of my career has been just luck, because a lot of the success I had at Oswego is due to having a really good assistant. And Deborah knew the territory, you know, understood it better than I did, was politically astute the way a legally trained person is. And she and I became a very good team.
That's great.
And I mention that because then when we lost our provost, Jane Milley, I appointed Deborah as the interim provost, and then she became the provost, and now I'm headed down to SUNY, having just been called, and part of what I've said to Tom Bartlett is, yeah, but you're going to need an interim person at Oswego, and you really ought to choose Deborah Stanley. So Deborah then followed me as the interim president. Mm. But then what happened is she became the president. Perfectly. She has done a spectacular job there. Okay?
Do you want to continue?
Well, let me finish that thought.
Yeah. Okay.
So I was really pleased that, as it happened, I could leave that campus in which I invested 7 years, Susan and I invested 7 years, in very good hands. And as I was saying, she's served that campus really well, and is still the president there now.
Oh.
So she served it as the interim president the year I was away, plus the last 15 years. Susan and I were back there just last fall to tour the campus and see some of the wonderful changes Deborah's made there. It's been a good, successful presidency and a pleasure to sort of watch that campus develop.
That's great, and it's great that you brought on somebody who you could feel so good about.
Yeah, I mean, but just as I never imagined that there was a university presidency in my future, she didn't imagine that at
yeah.
first either. But she's just been very well suited for it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a transition from the one to the other. That's
right. Okay, so let me just turn it on.
Yeah. While I was then at SUNY Oswego, at the SUNY System Office.
Right.
I was approached about doing this job. As I said, I was kind of interested in doing this job as it got as I learned more about San Diego State. And I was invited then to be one of 12 finalists. And this was an unusual process, and it was in November at that time. And so 12 of us were brought to Newport Beach, not to the campus here, but to Newport Beach. We were put in separate hotels so we wouldn't see each other because they wanted to keep this. And it's a small club, so we would have known each other. Wow. What are you doing here? And we were interviewed, and I flew back to New York after that. And then Monday or Tuesday, we'd get a call, and it would say, now there's six. We'd like to come back for another.
Oh, my.
So came back. And this was, you know, kind of what it's like to go spend 48 hours, go back to that. So it was an exhausting process. And then I was called for a third time, saying that they wanted me to come back. Now there were three of us. And I said, you know, I'm not prepared to consider a presidency when I haven't even been able to visit the campus. I'm just not, don't feel right about that. And they said, well, we're not doing presidential visits. And I said, well, then you ought to just cross me off the list. And then I got a call saying, well, we don't want to cross you off the list. Let us try something else here. And so they let me tour the campus, not with a university employee, but with an employee from one of our auxiliaries from our research foundation named Davine Gibson. And Davine is a wonderful, wonderful woman. And so my introduction to San Diego State, still as a candidate, is with Davine. And she walks me around campus, and I'm anonymous. I don't have any of the public interviews that are going on now, Big Four, all those things, which are the right way to select a university president. In this case, there's a very small committee of campus representatives that meet with me in these interviews up in Newport Beach, but not the normal sort of thing. So it's Davine that introduced me to San Diego State in the process. I think it was before my second visit, not my third. And that was very helpful in making me say, yeah, I would really like to do this job. Then one of the candidates withdrew, so there were two of us left.
Oh.
And the person who was the other candidate is a person that I had known professionally and very, very much admired. But I didn't know at the time that she was the other candidate. But she would have been an outstanding president. It has been an outstanding president throughout her career. But in any event, I came out, and the way this works then is you interview with the board, and the board makes a decision while you wait in a hotel room for the phone to ring one way or the other.
Oh.
And so the phone rang saying that I had the job and that they would come by and pick me up in 20 minutes. And we go over to be introduced to the board now and to the public as the next president of San Diego State. And so I called Susan in the interim to let her know the news. And I think I called Deborah maybe also. Maybe I called Deborah afterwards, because we didn't have much time. So in any event, I went over and was introduced and had a chance to meet Tom Day in Barry Munitz's office, just a quick conversation with Tom. So that was the first part of this. But the thing that's interesting about it is it was in mid-December. So I was appointed in mid-December to take a job in July of the next year. That's a long transition, mm-hmm. long interim. I mention that because I was then asked by the SUNY board to be, before they knew that I'd done this, I was asked to be the provost there.
Oh.
And I've always been so pleased that I had already made this commitment, because I might have been tempted by that. And
mm-hmm.
SUNY was such a quagmire in those years that it would have been a disastrous thing. It's just, again, dumb luck that these things worked out as they did. So then we had a long transition. Mm-hmm. Tom very rightly said he was concerned because it was December and he was still in charge of the university. So he said, there's only one president of San Diego State. You can hear, since you know Tom, you could hear him saying that. And that's exactly right. I said, no, I really believe that's exactly right. But I said, remember, that's true after July, just as it is before July. And Tom said, yes, that's exactly right. And Tom has honored that scrupulously. That transaction, that transition, actually took place over 6 months, a long time. Mm-hmm. Barry appointed me to Cornerstones, which was a system-wide strategic planning effort. So I was involved in California through Cornerstone stuff. I had a chance for a couple trips out here because we were looking for a house. We ended up renting a condominium in Coronado because the university didn't have a university house at that time. Mm-hmm. So that transition mm-hmm. took us through the spring, and we then arrived out here, I think, sometime in late June, and I believe Tom's last day was July 5th mm-hmm. as will mine be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Had you been to San Diego prior to that?
Mm. We had. But in two contexts. One, when we were in Minnesota, when folks from Minnesota escape the winter, the Southwest is a natural destination.
Right.
And as you know, it's off in Arizona.
I was going to say Phoenix.
Yeah, exactly. But it's also San Diego and Southern okay. California. So we knew it there, not from vacationing, but from professional meetings. So we'd been here a couple times. In fact, Susan and I both remember being out on Shelter Island at the restaurant out there that sort of looks down the harbor. I've forgotten the name of it. But sitting there having dinner on one of what to Minnesotans seemed to be an incredibly balmy evening, probably in February or something like that, and looking down the bay at the city and how beautiful it was, and saying, you know, we could imagine retiring here. This is a lovely place. Now, we weren't close to retiring yet, but we could sort of see that as a possibility because there's an attractive community. Then when I was at Oswego, and now as a campus president, you're involved more in fundraising and working with alumni and things like that. I would make occasional trips to the West Coast from Oswego because we had a lot of alums out here. And those trips would typically be San Francisco, L.A., San Diego.
Okay.
So you'd be out here for a week and you'd sort of do that loop. And there again, I got to know San Diego a little bit. We had 120 alums at that time in San Diego from Oswego. That's because Oswego produced a lot of teachers, and in the 60s, a lot of the jobs were in California, where the population was growing.
Right.
So for a lot of those reasons, and this was just as true in L.A. and San Francisco, so we had lots of alums out here, but there was one alum in particular who I got to know and who squired me around town a little bit, got to show me things. So I began to appreciate San Diego from that point of view. But frankly, for us, the attraction of San Diego has never been San Diego. It's been San Diego State.
Mm-hmm.
I always say to people that what's great about San Diego is that we're urban, we're diverse, we're high-tech, we're Pacific Rim, and we're Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
There are no palm trees in that list. And, you know, how much time do you spend on the beach, really?
Yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
So, but as an educator, this is a wonderful place to be an educator. So that's what attracted us, actually.
Yeah. Okay.